This is Geek Gab with your hosts, Dornall and me, Daddy Warpig. We are back. Geek Gab for Monday, March 25th, 2024. I was kind of stymied there for a second. I thought, man, it can't be March. But
it couldn't possibly be the end of March. It couldn't be spring already.
It snowed this morning up here. Like, I looked out the window, vehicles covered with snow, ground covered with snow. I mean, it melted off by like noon, but still, I was like, hey, what's all that white? Oh, yeah, I remember. So, but yeah, you know, hey, it's March, it's exciting. Things are happening. We got a post up on the blog today about some of the things going on in Hollywood. We touch on things are bad in Hollywood, economically bad in Hollywood.
That is good for the rest of us.
Things are also going kind of badly in the comic book and video game industries. And today's blog post kind of touches on that. So geek-gab.com to check out the blog. I'm excited. It is a choice for them to make bad stories that audiences hate, and when they do that and people stop watching their movies or reading their comics or buying the video games, then reality comes calling. And it looks like that's happening to a lot of different people. And it looks like things, either companies are going to go under, or things are going to start changing. So
we can only hope.
Yeah. Kotaku, and I'm laughing. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. It's terrible news. It's terrible news. It's tragic news. Are you ready to be heartbroken? Kotaku's owner has abruptly decided that their journalism, their brand of journalism, isn't working out. And so, effective immediately, everyone working for Kotaku is to stop doing reporting and editorializing and everything on games, and to focus entirely on making game guides. And each of them has to make 50 of them a week.
What?
50. That's not an exaggeration. 50 a week. So
that should be no trouble for anybody well-versed in ChatGPT or other generative AI.
So they have the editor-in-chief quit. A whole raft of other reporters have quit. And it is the speculation for a lot of people is there were a bunch of brands with Kotaku, and we talked about this before. There were a bunch of other brands that were all under one roof, right? That were all part of Gawker.
Yeah.
Jezebel, et cetera, et cetera. And when Gawker went under, they all got sold off. So they managed to keep on surviving. And they've recently all been being shut down by their owners. And it looks like it's now Kotaku's turn. And instead of paying out massive, if you fire someone, you have to give them like severance pay, and you have to, you know, depending on where they're living in or whatever, you have to give them maybe even training for their next job. That's a European regulation, whatever. So the thinking is that this is a way, demanding 50 guides a week is a way to get them to encourage them to self-fire so the owners don't have to pay out on their pay out on severance pay, that they just leave. And I don't want to say, you know, hey, Kotaku's dead, but for the most part, all their news is over, and they're now going to be writing what is effectively an impossible number of game guides a week. And if they don't do it, they're going to be fired for cause. instead of being laid off or whatever.
Sounds like something that won't fly in court, but I don't care. It couldn't happen to a worse level of scum than games journalists.
So the one thing that has come out that's going to be continuing their news, their one news thing is going to be continuing, is we talked about last week about Gamergate 2. Which I still can't believe is a thing. I want to tell you a story. This is a real story. Boris Yeltsin. I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah, he was the president of Russia.
Right. On one hand, he's missing, or he was missing, a thumb. And it's a big mystery to a lot of people why he's missing that thumb. I was fortunate enough to, while I was at college, sit in on a speech given by a journalist, for the Washington Post, who was over in Russia and got a chance to interview Boris Yeltsin and asked him about the thumb. And it turns out that when he was a little kid, he found an old World War II grenade. And he put it on a tree stump and he wanged it with a hammer. And it blew up, and it blew off his thumb, but it didn't kill him.
And wow.
Where this is relevant is both Gamergate and Gamergate 2 would never have happened if these idiots who started it had not gone around sledgehammering hand grenades. Like, they knew for a fact they were holding a hand grenade. And they just tossed it on a tree trunk and slammed it with a sledgehammer. And then when it blew up, they're walking around missing their thumb. And they're like, I'm being harassed. People are coming after me. I don't understand. This is so mean. And you're like, you moron. It was a hand grenade. Why the hell did you do that? So in the case of Gamergate 2, it was the employee of Sweet Baby Inc. who said, hey, let's go after this Steam group and let's go after this guy and brigade him and falsely report him and get his Steam group taken down and get his account taken down. So these literally, not an exaggeration, thousands of Steam games he's collected over for over a decade, more than a decade, they get all taken away so he can't play any of them. And if he hadn't done that, the Steam group, which had, you know, very, very few people, might have been a couple hundred, might have been 1,000, very few people, nobody would have paid attention to it. Nobody would have flocked to it. It would never have become Streisanded across the internet. And it now has 300,000 members. And it's blown up into this massive scandal. People are running for the hills. This week, there's an indie game that was completely revamped and rewritten because they're working with Sweet Baby Inc. And somebody, the guy who founded this group, added them to his list. And one of the people, one of the developers in charge of it, got in contact with him, said, no, we fired Sweet Baby Inc. and we're not doing that anymore. And then he said, okay, just, you know, show me that that's the case. Provide some evidence that that's the case. And then the developer blocked him, refused to provide any evidence. And then they deleted all that information from their website. And everybody is running from any association with this. And it's becoming like radioactive. And if only these other consultancy firms were becoming just as radioactive and other companies were seeing this and saying, hey, we're out of here. We're not going to do this consultancy thing anymore. We want sales. We want audience members. We don't want to go bankrupt. We don't want to shut down like Volition did when they did Sweet Baby Inc. and got all arrogant and told their fans they were pieces of crap and said haters going to hate and stuff. That was all Sweet Baby Inc. And all they had to do, all Sweet Baby Inc. had to do to avoid all of this happening was not try and brigade this one guy on Steam with this tiny group no one had ever heard of. All they had to do was not try and smash the grenade with the sledgehammer. And this wouldn't happen. But they couldn't do it. So, yeah, absolutely insane time this week. I just saw news story headlines where Microsoft is sending out guidelines to developers on the Xbox telling them not to make sexy women characters. I haven't read the story, but it's obviously, this is not over, but companies need to realize that they exist now in a post-PAL world, post-Helldivers 2, post-Baldur's Gate 3 world, and the standards for quality, the standards for interacting with their audience, the standards for what gamers expect companies to do are changing back to what they used to do. And they can't get away with just shoveling slop because people are going to step up and start providing games that come that the audience wants. It is not at all. And so either they're going to do that or they're going to go out of business sooner or later. And I'm hoping that, you know, I would like to see people start doing the right thing, but it doesn't look like they are. So to take this back to Kotaku, what I started saying was this person, I think her name is Alyssa McConte.
That's not a real name.
Yeah. She is the journalist who saw this situation and decided to report on it and omit the fact. Once it blew up, once it got Streisanded, she reported on the situation and decided to present it as suddenly gamers all across the world, hundreds of thousands of them, decided to attack Sweet Baby Inc. for no reason whatsoever. They just woke up one morning and all of them got enraged and attacked Sweet Baby Inc. because the people who run it are people of diverse color, of, you know, not being maleness, whatever. Just spontaneous rage. And again, her stories and the stories of other people who parroted it across the gaming journalism and across the mainstream media who picked it up in a couple of weeks after that, or in a week after that, blew it up. It's another instance of people slamming the hand grenade with a sledgehammer. If she hadn't done that, wouldn't have become such a big deal, but just couldn't help herself. So she has some interesting things have come out about her. She is the last vestige of supposed investigative journalists left at Kotaku. She's just been approved, supposedly, this is what she said in public, to do some news stories. What she's doing is she loathes and hates the streamer Melanie Mack, who had at one point become a convert to Christianity. And so she publicly posted requests for anyone to bring her dirt, so she literally in public on the internet where everyone can see, said, I want everybody to bring me anything they know about Melanie Mack, any dirt they have on Melanie Mack. I'm paraphrasing, because I'm writing a smear piece about her and I want all the dirt. And it's just, you're like, what? Do you not? This is so incompetent and ham-fisted. Absolutely incompetent and ham-fisted. It's like, again, this is the person who signed up for, infiltrated, quote-unquote, infiltrated a public Steam group, and their first post was because she wanted to tear the mask off this steam group. She wanted to infiltrate it and show what evils were going on. And her first post is, hey, why are you guys all so anonymous? Why don't you post your real names and addresses, huh? This is not a smart person or a subtle person. This is not a wise person, obviously. So, with all the subtlety of a person slamming a grenade with a sledgehammer, she announces she's going to go after Melanie Mack. And that's where it stands right now. But some things have come out about her. A picture has come out of her. She's taking a selfie. She's got a tattoo on her leg that says, all men are my enemy. Or all men are the enemy.
Classic.
Journalist. Sorry, I stepped on you.
Yeah, no, that classic man-hater.
And this is the thing. People refer to journalists disparagingly using terms like whores or prostitutes is the term I'm thinking of. Alyssa Mercante is literally, and I swear I am not making this up, she literally used to post for nude photos, and she literally is an ex-cam girl.
Uh-huh.
Prostitute is supposed to be a figure of speech, okay? This is not supposed to be a literal description.
Yet here we are.
And it reminds me of Gamergate, because that was the thing last week of how all of this was about Gamergate. How the primary person involved in Gamergate at the center of all this used to be posing for nudes. And everything that happened in Gamergate 1 is happening in Gamergate 2. So.
It's like poetry. It rhymes.
It rhymes. So here we are. And I'm really trying hard not to be cruel about this. People love to sneer at non-traditional journalists while at the same time dignifying people who work at game sites as journalists. They are the most unprofessional. Games journalists are the most unprofessional bunch of psychopaths, liars, corpo simps and losers you can imagine. And they are so unprofessional. It is offensive to me how unprofessional they are. Here we go. So, anyways, that's her. Apparently she's expanding her series into any streamer who has publicly undergone a change from who has converted to Christianity or undergone a change from being left wing to right wing, or, you know, left wing to libertarian, or even is still, you know, somewhat left wing, but is now standing up against the woke. I know she's targeting Brooms, lead developer on World of Warcraft, who is the other big figure in Gamergate 2.
Mark Kern.
Mark Kern, yep, who we've had on the show before. So we'll just have to see where it goes. So anyways, the last vestiges of Kotaku's journalistic integrity are being carried forward by a literal prostitute.
Sounds about right.
That, how do you write a more poetic conclusion to the Kotaku story than that? I just, seriously, as a fiction writer, you just have to, you know, you just have to applaud. That's beautiful. That's like the symbolism, right? The symbolism is utterly perfect. It could not be more beautifully stated. You would accuse them of being on the nose if someone had written this in a news story, in a fiction story, like a year ago. Hey, Kotaku's going out of business, but the last person to work for them, you couldn't have done it. People would have said, that's just too outrageous. That's just too on the nose to be, you know, maligning them that way. And here we are. So, one last bit of game news. Larian Studios, who made Baldur's Gate 3, which I still have not played, has declared they will not be making DLC, they will not be making Baldur's Gate 4, that their next endeavor will be an entirely original game. They are done with Wizards of the Coast, completely done, absolutely donezo.
So, that's a little surprising, but I'm judging by the way you said that Wizards of the Coast did something to sour that relationship.
Nobody knows what happened, and the CEO of Larian, who made this, who said this in response to a question, was very politic about it, but there are some facts. In the raft of layoffs, oh, and I should have included Wizards of the Coast, because I did in the blog post, they also had a bunch of layoffs because, you know, their business is going bad because they turned sharply woke. And they're also SBI, Sweet Baby Inc. You remember the Lord of the Rings Magic the Gathering set where Aragorn is now a diverse person of non-whiteness and all of those other crazy things?
I do. Guess not. Who,
you didn't know that? You didn't hear about that?
No.
Oh, it was a huge furor on the internet. Aragorn is a diverse person of non-whiteness and a bunch of other things like that throughout the set. And guess who consulted on that set?
Oh, it's got to be Sweet Babies.
Sweet Baby Inc. It's just this. It's like a soap opera. So anyways, Wizards of the Coast laid off lots of people in Dungeons and Dragons specifically. And all the people who got laid off are pretty much all the people that were working with Larian Studios. So even though Wizards of the Coast made something in the order, and this is the figure I saw, I have no idea of knowing how this is right or not. Even though they made something on the order of $80 million off of Baldur's Gate 3, yeah, I have talked about that on Twitter and on the show before. Do you want to read that comment?
Yeah. Bradford Walker, Wizards of the Coast run by ex-Microsoft and ex-Zynga execs. They're abandoning tabletop entirely for video games. And all of their moves and statements signal this with the subtlety of a brick to the face.
They just recently announced this last week again that they're going to be they're trying to develop AI as game mastering tools. My immediate surmise was not for use on tabletop, not for use on for Dungeon Masters on tabletop, but for use on like D&D 1, their virtual tabletop setting, so that people would be playing, instead of having a human game master, they'd be playing with an AI game master. Or they would be playing with a human game master who's being aided by AI. Just absolutely the absolute antithesis of actual real role playing. So my guess is, despite having made $80 million off of this, that they pulled a Darth Vader and said, "We're altering the deal. Pray we don't alter it further." And Larian just said, "Nope, we don't need this crap. We can go and do our own thing." And so they're going and doing their own things. They were a small studio. They didn't get any money from Hasbro. They didn't get any money from Wizards of the Coast. They paid to develop Baldur's Gate 3 all on their own. So everything that's in Baldur's Gate 3 is because they wanted it there. And they decided to dissolve that relationship and walk away. So they may have gotten a fan base large enough to be able to support their next games. And, you know, I wish them luck. My guess is that in addition to the money, they also mentioned that they were hamstrung by the 5th edition rule set. They didn't say the 5th edition rule set was bad, but they wanted to do some things with combat that they couldn't do because 5th edition wouldn't allow it. So they wanted to develop their own, you know, engine that would allow them to do some things with combat that they wanted to do. And I also was betting, based on what Wizards of the Coast is doing, that Wizards of the Coast was also pushing on them some of the same ESG DEI policies that have been ruining the rest of the video game industry. Because, and someone got upset at me for saying this on Twitter. They said, "Well, if you'd ever played Baldur's Gate 3, you know that Larian is down with whatever DEI policies Wizards of the Coast wants to push." And I didn't say this because I don't respond to people who come at me with disingenuous or raging at me. But they made characters who were female, who were physically attractive.
What? I don't think that's allowed.
It's not for most of the industry. It's not in Starfield. It's not in just a whole raft of other games. But their chief NPCs, who you can have romances with, you know, have curves. Apparently Microsoft is against now, but if Wizards of the Coast tried to push them away from that for Baldur's Gate 4, or even hinted at that, you can see how Larian, who has enough money, they have Get Lost money, or at least enough money to chart their own course, you can see how they'd be willing to say, nope, we're going to go do our own thing, because you didn't help us make this game. You didn't do anything to help make this game, so we're going to go make our own stuff. That was my guess. My guess was, you know, money, DEI, or both. And it turns out that it was probably both plus game mechanics from 5th edition not allowing them to do what they wanted to do.
I see.
So there is no Baldur's Gate 4 coming from Larian. Whoever Wizards of the Coast gets to do Baldur's Gate 4, it's probably going to be as awesome and as exciting as the Saints Row reboot. So you have that to look forward to.
Oh, that sounds good. Chat
seems dead industry that, walking, right?
Chat seems to think that they're going to do a bear dating simulator, or maybe something, with Adventure Conqueror King.
People have guessed they might do a third Divinity Original Sin. That was the first two computer role-playing games they did before Baldur's Gate 3. So they might do another sequel to that series. Wow, chat's been jumping today. I haven't looked, I'm sorry. And watch what I'm about to do here. I'm about to pull a rabbit out of my hat. We got a bunch of industries now that are dying. They're just walking around like, you know, like zombies.
Good one.
But no, seriously, there was a video game, and I can't remember which one, and part of the official background to the video game is a Netflix zombie series.
Yeah, man. Apparently, it's a few years ago.
Which you watched.
Yeah, I sure did. It was... did we talk about this on the show when it first came out? Black Summer.
Yeah, I watched Black Summer, and I watched Black Summer Season 2.
Yeah. Those two seasons were a couple years apart, and there's no sign of a Season 3. But the two seasons are available on Netflix.
It's not background to a video game. It's the origin to the Z Nation TV series. Okay, my bad.
What is Z Nation?
Z Nation's a different zombie television series.
So that doesn't make sense. Why isn't this show just Z Nation then?
Because Z Nation started later and was done and over before they made this. Z Nation finished in December 2018, and Black Summer debuted in April 2019. And the second season was in 2021.
All right. Weird. But I sat down, watched the first couple of episodes, and found it oddly engaging. So sat down and binged those two seasons of Black Summer. I don't recall what you said about the show when it came out, when you watched it. Did we talk about it here?
Yep, we did. We talked about it here 5 years ago.
That's a long time.
Almost exactly 5 years ago, because if it came out in April of 2019.
I am way behind. We're necroposting today.
I remember liking the first season Except maybe I didn't like the ending. That's what I'm remembering. I didn't like the ending of the first season. And then there was a bunch of interesting stuff in the second season. But I think I didn't think the second season was as good as the first.
It, your memory is correct. It was not. I don't think there's a surprise that they didn't go back to the well another time for that one. But it was strangely gripping. It was sort of the beginning of the apocalypse. It's set in somewhere in the U.S. about 5 weeks after the zombie infection spread, and so everybody's still not really sure what's going on, or whether any governments are still intact or anything, and they're not sure exactly how the zombies spread. So it's definitely, as weak word, it's tense, and it's sort of an interesting setup where you don't know anything, but also the characters don't know anything. But then we get to the first bad thing about the show that makes it, I guess it makes it a good horror show. I don't know if you thought this at the time, GW, but I'm pretty sure that the only people to survive the first few months of the zombie apocalypse were the dumbest people. Every character's really stupid. And the writers use the well-known trope of the idiot ball. And the idiot ball, it's even worse in the second season. Do you know what the idiot ball is?
Please, please regale us with the tale.
Okay. So have you ever watched a show and thought, wow, that character who last episode or last scene was really insightful and you know, saved the day and made a lot of good decisions, all of a sudden they do something completely idiotic and get themselves killed or get everybody killed or something bad happens, right? And you think, I can't believe they did that. It's like as soon as the plot required them to all of a sudden become an idiot, they just did it. As if someone just passed a ball to them and they caught it and they're like, what's this? Oh, that's the idiot ball. Now you're an idiot and you have to do whatever dumb thing the script requires. Okay. That's the idiot ball. And this show works heavily on the idiot ball because they've got this conceit where they break up the episode into all these scenes, but they label every scene. There's like a black title card and it'll have like a word that's the theme of the scene, like pull or push or whatever. And so as soon as you get to the viewpoint character, you know who's got the idiot ball for this scene. the conceit which made most of the first season really interesting and exciting, because they used that weird way of staging all the scenes to do interesting things like replay the same scene from multiple viewpoints.
Yes.
And at slightly different times. You'd be like, oh, you know, that first scene that we just saw, this next scene, it's halfway through this next scene that we're watching. So we're watching a few minutes before and then a few minutes after. While that's really engaging, it does wear thin. And in the second season, they actually don't know how to use it properly. Nothing happens in the second season that was improved by this storytelling structure. They could have just told the story straight and just natural, you know, chronological order for everything that happens. But in particular, in the first season, it makes for some exciting scenes. It also lets you know who has the idiot ball, and nobody in this dark future seems to be intelligent or smart or anything. If you're a fan of zombie movies, which I know you are. Now, I never saw Z Nation, so this was new to me. But
it has nothing to do with Z Nation.
Oh. Like,
nothing.
Well, except that the way zombies procreate, I guess, isn't like most other stories. There's no infection or virus that anybody's aware of. It simply is the case that when a person dies, they immediately turn. Like as soon as they breathe their final breath, you know, their eyes go glassy for a second, and then they immediately get up and turn into a ravenous monster. And they start chasing after people, you know, and beating them to death. That was kind of interesting and kind of scary. I thought they did a pretty good job with that sort of thing, because it had to, you know, had some interesting implications. Like once people started to figure out how it happened, they would do clever things. Like a villain would, you know, shoot a guy in the gut, and you know, as his someone he's associated with is about to execute the victim, he says, "No, let him turn." And so he'll stop everybody else. You know, he'll be trouble for everybody else, and we can get to the prize. You know, whatever thing they're fighting over that episode. I mean, once you get past how dumb the whole thing is, and we talk about this all the time, like there's the admission you have to pay to get in. It's as dumb as any other zombie movie you've ever seen. But once you grant the premise, it's kind of fun. Warning, though, if you're extra sensitive to modern Hollywood's or modern Netflix's woke writing and casting, downsides of this include, and they even say it in season two in a scene, like, competent adult males don't last long in this dark future. I guess the implication is because they're too busy fighting and shooting each other. Well, anyway, they do most of the shooting and most of the getting dead. Every character who is smart and successful must be diverse, with the exception of the two sort of main characters that you follow through most of the series, through both seasons, a mother and daughter team. The father, of course, dies right off the bat in the very first episode, to no one's surprise. While villainy is shared by all walks of life, you know, the most truly heroic actions are done by the most diverse crowd. Sort of your standard fare. You were right about the ending. The ending to both seasons was actually kind of disappointing. A little underwhelming, but there's really no good way to end a series that's just about watching horrible things happen to people because it's the end of the world and there are zombies everywhere. There's sort of nowhere to go with that. But I will grant the second season, despite being much worse than the first, it does finish off with one scene with some pretty grand heroics. And I was actually like yelling at the TV, "Finally, someone kicks a bunch of zombies' asses." that was a nice treat for the end of it. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah, go ahead.
No. Please.
I was gonna say, if you're still foolish enough to give Netflix your money, you at least watch the first season. It's pretty good.
Yeah, but and this is my dim recollection. At one point, you know, the people will be driving along in a truck. Another truck will pull up behind them, and a bunch of other people will jump out and rob them and take all the stuff. And you'll be watching the scene from one point of view and seeing everything that happens. And then the people will be scared and they'll run off because they're not, you know, the main characters, the people you're following aren't involved in this. They're not in either truck. They're just seeing this happen. And maybe they scare off the thieves or whatever, and then they run off. And then the next episode, it jumps back in time and you'll see how these four people who are in the truck, who robbed the other guys, how they get together, what happened to them, why they, you know, decided to rob this other truck, and what happened to them after they robbed the truck. And then you find out that one of the people from this truck ends up hooking up with the main characters who saw them do it from earlier. So it's this intersecting sort of quilt almost of threads of individual tales. Mm-hmm. Because all these people are in the same town, you know, and they're in the same small area. They're trying to all get to the same stadium. And so it's not a bunch of coincidence because they're all in the same bunch of streets and they're all being channeled towards the same area. So they're going to interact. And it's just showing you all these little interactions and how they played out and what happened beforehand as they're all trying to get to the stadium to get to safety and be evacuated. So I'm sure I've got some of the little details wrong there, but that's how the first season plays out. And it works really well in the first season and doesn't work so well in the second season.
Yeah. The second season doesn't have that structure. The weird interconnected storytelling doesn't serve anything. It doesn't serve any purpose.
Well, because there's no funnel. It takes place on such a wide area, such a huge area. It takes place in woods and on mountainsides, and people are trekking over long distances, and there's this one house up on a hill, and there's, if I remember correctly, there's two groups who come together to fight over some supplies, and then the mom and the daughter hook up with someone, and then they're off to walk towards someplace. There's no real reason why these stories really interconnect. And so by and large, they don't. And it's just, it's kind of a wasted. There's nothing that your typical flashbacks or straightforward storytelling wouldn't also accomplish.
Yeah. There is a funnel, but it's sort of nonsensical because there's a airplane that's dropping supplies for survivors.
Oh.
And so everybody's trying to find their way to the
airplane.
They want to know where the plane's flying out of and try to get to that plane so that they can get a ride out, which doesn't make any sense because nobody knows where the airfield is. Yet all the characters you find throughout the season are sort of funneling sort of in the snow along roughly the same path, and they keep running into each other over and over again, and they're killing each other off, you know, and they whittle themselves down to only a few. And it doesn't make any sense because, you know, the one guy who knows where the airfield is doesn't really, maybe he kind of knows where it is, but also he's completely crazy and just happened to be hiding in a house somewhere. Like at the beginning of the story, everybody was just sort of all going in the same direction for no reason. Yeah. We've got some great questions in the chat. I'm going to answer these questions. I was just going to answer these questions. I have no idea. Do zombies get sunburns? They are quite affected by the weather. I don't know if they get sunburns. I don't think they'd feel it. But the sun works on dead flesh just like it works on living flesh. And what happens if a zombie and a werewolf bite each other at the same time? Well, in this setting, zombies don't spread by biting. So the zombie bite does nothing to the werewolf, and the werewolf. But do we get? Does the zombie turn into a werewolf? Probably not. I don't know. Maybe when the zombie dies, it turns into a werewolf. Would the werewolfism heal? No. I don't think so. Thanks, Dunder Moose. Appreciate it. Go check out Dunder Moose's channel. You get answers to great questions like that. He'd have better answers than I do.
So, yeah, I did. I enjoyed the first season a lot, and I would recommend giving it a watch. If you, it's a fun zombie series. I didn't enjoy the second season as much, and I don't remember really saying watch it. There were some interesting things about it. If you like zombie media, it's a for people who are fans of zombie shows, it's an above average zombie show, but it's not worth your time if you just want some good TV to watch. It's okay. It's mediocre. But if you're not a fan of zombie shows, it's not going to make you real excited. It won't convince you to watch zombie movies.
Yeah, I co-sign on that, except to say, you know, I'm not a big zombie fan. So if you're like me and you watch the first episode and you're like, yeah, all right, I could get into this, then you will enjoy it in spite of its flaws. If only, and believe me, half the episodes, it was just making fun of just how stupid the characters were. That was actually half the fun.
The ambulance from season two was actually a pretty rough scene. They actually did that pretty well, the ambulance. And the chase from the ambulance. That was good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised you remember that.
Good stuff in season two.
With characters that basically aren't important to the story at all. They're not part of the story. It was just one of those little vignettes, and it was more interesting than everything else that happened in the season.
Unfortunately. But it takes place in the first episode, so.
There you go. Watch the first season and the first episode of season two and stop.
Anyways, you were saying.
Well, I just wanted to wrap up. I did want to talk about AD&D a little bit, Dungeons & Dragons. We've been doing a lot of gaming, especially since Macho Mandalf's been unavailable to Dungeon Master lately. First of all, you can get session reports at my blog at dornal.blogspot.com. I wanted to call out some things that sort of jumped out at me. First of all, we've gone 13 sessions without naming the mega dungeon. That seems wrong. We're going to need another one. But I'm excited to say that we finally hit a point where the players knowledge and investment in the game has really started to pay off, and we're only 13 sessions in, and the game is really starting to build upon itself instead of just being a bunch of nonsense rooms or whatever, monsters, orcs everywhere. 2 weeks ago, we had an interesting situation where they were exploring a new part of the dungeon. The big mega dungeon. And there's two interesting things happened. From my side, I was sort of working at the edge of the paper. So I was thinking extra hard about how the dungeon layout would happen, using my discretion as far as what sorts of rooms and things I rolled up. And then when I got a monster result, an unusual monster result, how do I use that? You know, in this case, there's a bunch of troglodytes. So I had to come up with ideas. Okay, what might they be doing here in a section of the dungeon that should be predominantly controlled by orcs? And where might they have come from? And I came up with a few answers, sort of naturally came up from the dice, the roll of the dice. But at the same time, it really helped that part of the dungeon come alive in my mind. And I hope it was the same for the players. And I think it did, because as soon as they encountered the monsters and the monsters fled, they looked at their map and realized, wait, we've been around this area. If we backtrack down another part, down another hallway, we should be able to come around and catch them retreating, or at least figure out where they retreated to without having to go through unexplored rooms. We'll just go around back the way we came and see if we can cut them off. And it worked. They had their maps. Their memory was correct. The map was correct. So that when they moved around, sure enough, they actually encountered those monsters again, only the scenario was in their favor and they were able to defeat them. I was sort of sitting up in my seat, really proud of that. That was really cool gaming. And the sort of thing that happens when players sit down, they take the game and the game world seriously and do just a little bit of effort, making sure that their maps are fairly accurate, trading notes, talking about it, making plans. Yeah, Mustasha with his map. And really cool tool for, what's that website they were using for maps? There's a great website, Dungeon Scrawl. We've got Brig in the party. He's just using Dungeon Scrawl Live. As I describe the dungeon, he's trying to sketch it out in that, and he'll post screenshots to the Reason Discord chat, right? And so everybody's kind of, everybody has a better time understanding where they're at in the dungeon, and it's been really good for the players. So they've been taking that stuff more seriously, and it really pays off in terms of making them think about the dungeon and take it seriously as a hypothetical place that could exist. And you know my theory on role-playing games. You know that when the players treat their characters as if they're in a world and treat the world as a real place or a potential real place, that's when you get that, well, they call it immersion. That's when you get everybody sort of in tune with what the ref is presenting, and that's when the magic happens. That's when really interesting play and ideas happen. What happened in the last one? The last session was a lot of fun. The party finally got to grow out from their little mega dungeon area, do some wilderness exploration, and they fought more orcs. Dead orcs, but orcs nonetheless. I don't have much to say about that. It was a lot of fun to run that session, but nothing jumped out at me quite the same, except that they found a new dungeon that was, oh, now I recall. Something really strange happened to me, and forgive me if this is overlong, but in Dungeons & Dragons, when you leave your hometown and you start adventuring in the wilderness, the types of monsters you might encounter vary greatly in size and power. It's not like a carefully controlled dungeon where you figure, well, we're on level 2 of the dungeon, and so all the monsters are going to be around the same power level. No, you could easily run into, you know, a band of 20 friendly hobbits or a red dragon. And you're level 4, and there's nothing you can do about that red dragon. If it decides it wants to eat you, or if you decide that you think you can take it on, it's just going to kill you, right? And that happened, not the red dragon, but on their first evening, they ran into an encounter so evil, so powerful, that if any player made a mistake or a die roll had gone the wrong way, maybe 10-20% the wrong direction, that they absolutely would have been wiped out. But instead, the players thought about it, considered carefully my description of the monsters, which looked very much like people, and their behavior and what they said, and they intuited, okay, we don't need to do this right now. That's two things. That encounter did two things. And I can't spoil it here because they don't know the nature of the monster yet. But I will spoil that now I have established in one of the wilderness areas, in a 6-mile hex, if you will, there is a powerful monster or a powerful group of monsters that the party or someone else, you know, the players, may want to deal with at some point in the future. And if I needed a powerful monster, for example, that may have interests or plans or whatever, their own army or faction, if you will, in that part of the wilderness, I now have a piece that I can put on the board. I didn't have to make this piece up before the game. I didn't have to write a history of this area of the wilderness and for why this creature might have its lair somewhere in these, you know, in these mountains or forests or whatever, right? It came up organically from the roll of the dice, and boom. As soon as the game gave me this information that this, you know, this powerful monster is in the forest, in this location, I was able to take that feedback and turn it into something that either the players ignore it or I ignore it, or it could have a great impact on the campaign, depending on how I want to use them, depending on what I think their plans might be, or what's their purpose, or what's their goals, or if maybe there's a Battle Bronstein and you want to put armies of monsters against each other. I've got a whole new faction made up for me on the spot, generated by the game, but driven by the players. Think about that. The players generated this faction, or caused it to be generated, just by interacting with the world. I can't say enough good things about this game. And it's my favorite part. On a personal note, my favorite part of a Dungeon Master is all those times when I get to kill Bob's character. No, that's not it. All the times when I get to exercise my discretion, when the game feeds you back just enough information that you have gameable content, and I as the ref or the dungeon master get to make that or try to make that come alive for the players. And I don't mean with a funny voice. Just adding those little details, like, okay, well, great. Now, you know, the monster table has handed me 10 zombies that surprised the party. What do I do with this? Right? You set the stage. The parties enter the dungeon. Here comes the zombie surprise. You know, they look like orcs. That'll be sure to piss them off. That worked, by the way. That sort of thing. It's one of the most enjoyable parts of the game. It's my favorite part of being a ref. It's good fun. And I hope it continues. We've got a pretty good thing going, and I guess that just wraps it up.
Last thing I want to say is the regular play of RPGs has always been hard finding game masters, and the hobby has been slowly dying. And even though there's been a slew of people who have come into Dungeons & Dragons since Critical Role, they're not really playing role-playing games. They're all trying to play Critical Role. Which is something different than actual Dungeons & Dragons. One of the strengths of running things using the BrewSR methods is that pretty reliably, people who are players step up and become game masters because of the tools that the game affords you, that the game provides. And one of the things that, as Dungeons and Dragons gets further and further from its roots with the clear direction that clear direction and going towards a video game that the current executives are pushing it in, you're going to want to and need to see these kinds of methods spread and provide an alternative both to their AI-driven nightmare Dungeons and Dragons, which is as far from the creativity of actual Dungeons and Dragons as I can imagine, and an alternative to the short-lived campaigns and painful, overburdened GMs of, you know, what role-playing games on the whole have turned into since then. And a hobby that can, in games that can take these principles and apply them to genres other than just Dungeons and Dragons, will have a competitive advantage in because they're viral. People will play them. Game masters will be generated from the table and start their own tables, and they're going to spread. And they will have the advantage of human ingenuity. They'll have the advantage of human creativity. And I'm not waving a revolutionary flag here or anything, but I happen to think it has to be innately superior to the gray ooze of this nightmarish AI-driven future, because AI isn't creative. It just takes pre-existing terms and, using an algorithm, swaps them around, kind of mimicking what human beings have already created. And if human beings hadn't already created it, wouldn't be able to do that. And I just don't think that once people get a taste of the real thing, but they're going to be able to think so highly of the experience they get with AI game mastering. And I'm not saying there won't be those who prefer it, because obviously they will, but I think that this style, the BrewSR style of gaming, is what's going to be an antidote to the AI future, and it's going to be, you know, BrewSR AI with everything else being a small remnant, is my feeling. So.
Yeah. Yeah, you may be right. I can't help but think of one of my old friends I used to play Cyberpunk with in high school. I don't know if AI is going to get him what he wants, but he loves the idea of a computer RPG that was more like his face-to-face games with a super friend storyteller DM where it you know, it responds organically to the players and what they do and say. And I get it. You know, I get it. He's definitely that type of player, and he would enjoy something like that. But what's AI going to come up with? Gray goo? No. What you really want is let computers do what they're really, really good at, right? Crunch the numbers. And if you want to computerize the entirety of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, that could be very effective. But you're not going to get anything good or interesting or indeed human out of a machine trying to mash some meaning together. Having a player at the table, namely the ref, actually do that for everybody really is what's going to make it. It's what's going to bring the game alive. And I'm grateful to the Brosar and everybody for hashtag thank you Jeffro. Thank you, Jeffro. I'm grateful for being able to play in Trollopolis and DM for these guys because it's fantastic. It's one of those things that might have been lost, especially if it had just been relegated to, you know, the three grognards who have been playing for 40 years and never bothered telling anybody. This is great stuff. And it's prime gaming. And I think you're right. And I hope it grows, but I think you're right about it being sort of the, what, how'd you put it? Just a place where a refuge for people to play this way. While most of the hobby's gone towards the brand and the critical role in the AI. Normally, you could always play Palladium Fantasy. I don't think I'm going to do that, Megabuster Shepherd. But thanks for listening.
All right, folks. This has been Geek Gab for Monday, March 25th, 2024. We want to thank everyone who tuned in, listened live, participated in the chat, and we want to thank everyone who will tune in and listen later. We are here just about every week at just about the same time, Monday, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, youtube.com/geekgab. Once again, that's youtube.com/geekgab. Go ahead and subscribe. Click the bell icon so you'll receive the notification as to when we go live. Please feel free to help out with our Patreon or Subscribestar. Links in the description below. So we can defray some of the costs of running the channel. You can also catch us on the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on SoundCloud.com. Download us to the device of your choice, or just listen to us on your PC. We are signing out for today, folks. But don't you worry. Don't you fret. We will be back.